Welcome to the Making Sense podcast. This is Sam Harris. We're trying something new here today. In this episode, I'm answering questions based on the topics that many of you submitted over on Substack. And if this goes well, we'll do more of this in the future. The voice you hear is that of my manager and business partner, Jaron Lowenstein. Jaron sat down with me to discuss the questions we fielded from the community chat at Substack. I think there were some 4,000 comments, so this is just the tip of the iceberg. But many of you have been calling for me to respond more quickly to topical events. So that is the experiment we are performing for you today. This is audio from the video that we recorded, and subscribers can watch the full video and comment and submit further topics over on my Substack page. Enjoy.
So let's start with what the hell is going on? How's your stock portfolio, Sam?
Well, this is looking expensive. That was the, I just looked at the Economist cover story editorial, which was about as withering as you could imagine. They called the day of liberation, the day of ruination. And I'm not an economist. I just know that the vast majority of economists think this is an insane self-inflicted wound. I guess time will tell, but it certainly seems that way. It's just crazy that one person's fixation on tariffs can accomplish this for us. I don't know who really wanted this, but it's we seem to be running a global experiment on the economy. And could he be proven right in the end? I guess it's possible, but it's against the grain of seemingly all of economic understanding of the last 100 years.
Well, that's interesting you said that, because one of the things that we're hearing is this idea that, you just have to wait, especially from the MAGA people that are, now into buy the dip, and this is all going to be okay. I mean, they were griping about the price of eggs, right? Yeah. And now they'd give anything to pay $12 for eggs again. Maybe that's the move. But it sounds like you actually have a glimmer of optimism that...
No, zero optimism.
No.
I think this is very likely to be a disaster. I mean, Trump is a fake businessman, right? He's a fake business genius. He's a game show host. And somehow the country decided... I mean, he was not even... famous for being famous, nearly fake real estate developer, right? Who had a great talent for going bankrupt and losing other people's money and then getting sued and not paying his subs, et cetera, right? The least ethical businessman anyone's ever met, and not a successful one. The irony is now he's probably a legitimate billionaire, at least for the next 5 minutes, because of the meme coin he sold to a credulous horde of people who bought it simply to support him. And now we have foreign governments that will be buying it to support him in an exercise in corruption, the likes of which we have never lived through, at least to my knowledge, in this country. I mean, it's completely insane that this person's ideas about the economy are operative. But is it conceivable that all the economists are wrong and that tariffs are going to work, or that this thing that he could pull back from the brink in a way and look like a winner because he just shocked all of our allies and enemies simultaneously with how irrational he could be? I mean, that's totally possible. I mean, the irony for me is that it seems like an economic catastrophe is the only thing that stands a chance of convincing his cult that they made a bad decision. And I think it's legitimate to worry whether it would even convince them in that case. I mean, a global depression might not convince the 30% of Americans who are truly in the cult. But, among the people I know who voted for Trump, who really, imagined that he, at a minimum, would steward the economy in ways that would be, if not advantageous for all of humanity, advantageous for them, I can imagine them recognizing that we all made a bad decision, or they made a bad decision in supporting him. If there's a sufficient economic downturn, the painful irony for me is that that's not the reason to have recognized how insane it is to have promoted this guy to the highest position of responsibility of anyone in our society. I mean, what's insane is that just before he shuffled out to the Rose Garden to announce these lunatic tariffs, he was meeting with Laura Loomer about national security in the Oval Office. That's what's insane about the Trump administration, right? We have grifters and lunatics and conspiracy theorists advising the president on how to manage, you know, risk of nuclear annihilation with Russia and China and our other adversaries. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, to say nothing of the fact that you've got RFK Jr. in there promoting anti-vaxxers and firing, you know, half the staff of the FDA and who knows who else he's going to fire. It's madness, right? That's the thing to be agitated about. And the fact that there could be an associated price tag with it is all too foreseeable. But in my mind, if you're going to come to your senses just because your 401k took a nosedive, you still haven't pulled your head out of your ass. This is a disaster on 100 fronts. And in 2 months, Trump has accomplished the unthinkable. He's ruined the reputation of our country, perhaps for a generation. I mean, he's convinced our allies that they can't possibly trust us, right? Because they can't trust us, right? We elected a moral lunatic to the office, and he's rescinded all of our treaty obligations, effectively, single-handedly, and he's acting like we lost a war with Russia, right? Like last I looked, we had won the Cold War. It seems like we've lost it now, or we switched sides at the 11th hour, and now he's doing the bidding of a dictator who, at the time we're recording this, seems to be playing him for a fool in the negotiations vis-a-vis the war in Ukraine, but who knows how that's going to come out. But the fact that we have announced to the world that we no longer stand with freedom-loving democracies that aspire to live the way we do in the developed world. We no longer stand with open societies against naked aggressors. We stand with aggressors because, you know, the guy covered in orange face paint may want a hotel deal in Moscow one of these days. It's mortifying, right? That's the thing to be agitated about. And yeah, so it's just going to be an extra level of annoyance to see an economic calamity convince people finally that maybe this was a bad decision.
I want to go back to the signal situation with Hegseth. To me, and I want to get your thoughts on this, to me, it just, that was it was such an easy opportunity for integrity. They could have still lied. They could have said nothing, there was nothing classified, but there was a fuck up and we're looking into it and one of us did this and that shouldn't happen. That's embarrassing. And we do better. We know better. We're, as you said, anybody would have been fired for that. Why is that? And going back to the Trump prerequisites that you talked about, is it possible, I'm purely making this up, although Griffin said that it was in his movie, I guess, The Apprentice, that there's a scene that he was talking about this. Is it possible that in Trump's pre-meeting, he tells everybody, listen, if you fuck up, just double down. Like, don't ever, like, the media will kill you. Don't ever apologize. Just fucking lie, and stay through it and just believe your story. And you'll get through it and I'll back you up, but no need to, you know, admit that. And then on that too, I mean, I saw, what's her name? Tommy Lauren had come out, she's a right wing or Republican pundit, had come out and said, listen, guys, just take the fucking L on this. This is easy. Just take the L. Like, why couldn't they do that? Like, why was that such an easy opportunity? And we watched them on the other side, ask for the same thing. Why is that so hard to have just one area where you could fuck up and just say, okay, look, we it wasn't confidential. You can, again, you keep your lie, but why is it, right? Why couldn't they, is it just, I mean, I don't think these people all lack integrity. There must be something, as you said.
You can be sure they do. I mean, that's what he's selected for. Yeah, I mean, no one passes through that sieve with integrity. Well, I mean, it's a famous piece of advice that has been talked about. I'm sure it's in actually some of Trump's fake autobiographies that he didn't write, where Roy Cohn gave him the advice that you do never admit a mistake, right? I mean, that's and you just lie and change the subject and move on, but you never apologize and you never admit that you were wrong about anything. even when it's obvious to everybody. And it's part of, you know, the a generic, you know, authoritarian or fascist playbook. I mean, it, paradoxically, the harder the lies are to believe, I mean, really the impossible lie functions even better in this kind of environment because it functions like a loyalty test, right? Like this is code for being in the cult. And what it does is it nullifies everybody's efforts to even understand what is going on in the world. I mean, this is, you know, Steve Bannon's point of, you know, flooding the zone with bullshit. It was Hannah Arendt's point in the origins of totalitarianism that you know, a sufficient amount of lying is not designed to get people to believe these falsehoods. It's designed to get people to believe nothing, right? It's to get them to declare epistemological bankruptcy, so that they just realize, okay, who knows what's going on in the world? It's not my job to know what's going on in the world. I'm just going to be obedient and keep my head down. I'm just going to put a sign in the window, you know, claiming to believe the big lie, so that no one drags me out of my shop and beats me to death on the sidewalk, right? I mean, like that's where this heads when there are no checks on it, right? This is the history of fascism, and there's no question that Trump is an authoritarian. His every inclination is to govern as an authoritarian, and his lying is a principal part of that. I mean, he just lies about everything, and he lies in ways that are clearly not meant to successfully deceive anyone. I mean, it's crucial to realize the difference, right? You know, when Lance Armstrong is lying about doping, you know, in the Tour de France, he is really trying not to get caught, right? He is just kind of doing the cognitive math, trying to remember what he said last time. You know, he's applying pressure to people covertly. He's trying to keep secret whatever he can keep secret, right? He's having conversations behind closed doors. He is trying to get away with it, right? And to be believed. And then finally, it all kind of smashes into an obstacle that he can't navigate, right? Which is the fate of many frauds and many liars. That is not what Trump is doing. And that is not what Trump has done for decades now. He lies in ways that are totally transparent, right? He'll tell you a building he built is 10 stories taller than it is in fact, right? And all you have to do is stand outside and count the floors. It's all bullshit, right? And this is a fascist style. Oh, I mean, it doesn't matter when you're a fucking game show host, but when you bring it into a government, this is why people are worried about fascism, right? Because this is the fact that you can have half of a society claiming to believe the unbelievable is terrifying. I mean, this is so upside down. The right wing has been complaining about George Soros funding things, right, that are of interest to people on the far left. Now, that seemed worth complaining about. But now look at what Elon is doing. Who's complaining about that? And what Elon is doing is so much more intrusive, so much more corrupt, so much more a matter of self-dealing. I mean, he's getting regulators fired who are regulating his companies. Right, I mean, it's not even on the same part of the map as what George Soros has been accused of, and I'm not even sure that all the accusations leveled at Soros are true. But assuming they are true, it's nothing like what Elon is involved in.
And you think there's no way to steel man Elon for at least his intentions at all at this point?
Not at this point, because I know what he does when you point out his obvious errors, right? Errors that are really harming people's lives. He does nothing about it, right? He doesn't apologize. He doesn't correct them. He just tells you to go fuck yourself and he moves on. If we ever have, you know, a full eruption of anti-Semitic intolerance in America or Western Europe again, if we really descend into something awful, much of the responsibility will be on Elon at this point because of what he's done on X, because how he's turned X into a platform for the world's anti-Semites. And it's not just anti-Semitism, it's white supremacy, it's fascism, it's, you know, every species of bigotry and awfulness. He has made it the preeminent platform for all of that. Not just the sentiment, but the conspiracy thinking and the lying and the distortion of reality that turbocharges all of it. And not only has he done that as a matter of, you know, tuning the algorithm and bringing the worst actors back on with great fanfare, you know, bringing Nick Fuentes back on and Alex Jones and
Kanye.
But he's done it in the way he's personally interacted with these accounts and passed on misinformation, right? You know, personally to over 200 million followers. And when any of this gets pointed out to him, he does not care, right? And so it's in that context that, you know, you have to see his, you know, Hitler salutes that are, no one thinks are Hitler salutes, right? And I don't even think they're Hitler salutes, right? I mean, it's like, it's crazy to think that he really was invoking that reference when he Zig Heiled twice. But the guy is always, if only by accident, promoting Nazis and far-right lunatics and conspiracists and liars, right? He's not accidentally amplifying trans activists and far-left conspiracists and liars. So to ascribe it to error seems pretty far-fetched. I mean, the error he's never making is to criticize the Chinese Communist Party, right? If he's just a bull in a china shop making mistakes everywhere, well, then he would make errors of that kind. He never makes those errors, right? He's only amplifying right-wing intolerance. And it's completely irresponsible. It's unforgivable at this point. And yeah, so, you know, what could people do in response? I mean, you know, the vandalism and violence directed at Tesla is obviously the wrong thing to be doing. I mean, one, it's illegal. Two, it victimizes innocent people who just bought a Tesla because they thought it was a great car. And it is a great car, right? It's like, just think of someone who stretched to buy a nice car and love the car until yesterday, and now people are hurling abuse at them or, you know, keying their car or worse, right? It's awful, right? Like, it's just, and whoever's doing that, I mean, these are almost certainly far left dummies. It's totally counterproductive. But what would not be counterproductive is a full-on boycott of Tesla, right? That would be, insofar as that's happening, I think that's a entirely good thing. It sounds like it's happening in Western Europe. I would love to see Tesla stock get beaten down to a plausible, you know, price to earnings ratio, which is 1/10 of its current value, because I think that's, you know, I think that would be a totally appropriate ethical response to what Elon is doing in the world, right? I mean, and it seems to be the only signal that could conceivably matter to him or anyone close to him, right? I mean, if you're going to imagine what it would take to rein him in, you know, to have his board of directors, one of his board of directors rein him in, it would only be something like that. And I'm not even sure he would care at this point. He's got obviously many other irons in the fire beyond Tesla, right? He's got SpaceX. He's got other, you know, he'll be spectacularly wealthy even if Tesla goes to zero. But it's the only lawful mechanism we have to resist his obviously unethical and I think probably unlawful behavior at this point.
Well, I want to talk about somebody who's responsible for that in large part, and somebody who may have gotten Trump elected, and somebody who I actually believe that you do believe has good intentions and is doing well and means well. And I wonder, I know that your friendship, and I'll tell you what it is in a second, but one of the things we're thinking about is, would you ever have Rogan on your podcast?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't occurred to me, frankly. It would be a hard conversation at this point. I mean, I'm out of touch with Joe for, you know, fairly obvious reasons, and that makes it difficult to think about how that conversation would go. Obviously, he's wandered pretty far into Trumpistan, not for real reasons of partisanship, but just, you know, based on the allergy I think all of us have had to the far left. But he's been very slow to acknowledge the significance of his platform for, you know, the quality of life of people everywhere, really. I mean, he's got the world's largest media platform, very likely. And he doesn't seem to me to have admitted that to himself, and because it would require that he take more responsibility than he has to get his facts straight. He thinks that the alibi that he's continuously invoked, that he's just a comic, you know, just having fun conversations, is good enough at this point to insulate him against valid criticism. And I just don't think that's the case. It hasn't been the case for a very long time. And insofar as I've communicated with him in recent years, I've tried to nudge him in the direction of, you know, correcting some errors or, you know, having some balance on his podcast. But I haven't done too much of it, frankly, because it seems like it doesn't accomplish anything. And I haven't wanted to blow up the relationship because I like Joe a lot, and I think he's a good person, but he's not serving a good role now on the information landscape. He's done some things that have been quite harmful, I think inadvertently. I think he's genuinely, I don't think he's a bad actor in the way that I think Elon is now, because Elon knows what he's doing. Is it because it's been pointed out to him so clearly, and I've done it personally, and I know what his personal response to me is, right? I've shown him exactly how he was defaming me, right? And his response was, go fuck yourself. And I don't think I would ever get that back from Joe. I know I wouldn't, right? If Joe said something about me on his podcast that was totally false and harmful to my reputation, and I pointed it out to him, there is absolutely no way his response would be, go fuck yourself. Right. Zero. The probability of that is zero. Right. Because I think Joe is a much different person than Elon. You know, I'm just forced to admit now that I never knew Elon, right. Or that he's changed. There's been some wholesale firmware change in his brain in recent years. But I think he is absolutely a bad actor who has completely become, you know, unmoored, if he ever was moored ethically. I don't think Joe is like that. I think Joe is a genuinely good guy who wants good things for people, but he is honestly in over his head on so many topics of great consequence, right? When he brings someone on to just shoot the shit about, you know, how the Holocaust is not what you think it was, right? Or, and, you know, maybe Churchill's the bad guy in World War II.
Is that Tucker?
Or he's got Dave Smith, you know, being treated as an expert on Israel and Palestine and the history of that conflict and the moral emergency that came to the world's attention on October 7th and what is appropriate to think in the aftermath of all of that, right? Dave Smith is the only reason why anyone knows what Dave Smith thinks about any of this is very likely because Joe had him on multiple times to talk about it, right? You know, he's a pure misinformation artist and, you know, on top of many others. And when Joe talks to someone like Trump or Tucker Carlson or, you know, any of these other guys who lie as freely as they breathe and doesn't push back against any of their lies, in fact, and, you know, in Trump's case, really fairly energetically helped put his lies into the most plausible possible shape, it is irresponsible. I mean, it is directly harmful. Our society is as politically shattered as it is, in part because of how Joe has interacted with information. Again, I don't think this is, I think a lot of this is inadvertent, or maybe all, you know, all of it's inadvertent, but it is also avoidable, right? He could actually take the responsibility that really is his to take at this point to get his facts straight and have someone other than Jamie there riding shotgun with him, where, I mean, he could have two brilliant journalists whose full-time job, he could pay each of them $1 million a year just to sit there and make sure he doesn't put his foot in his mouth in a colossally irresponsible way. It would be very simple to do a better job than he's doing, and he just doesn't seem to see any need for it, and yet the need is excruciating.
I do think reachable.
One thing I should point out is that Joe is only the most consequential case here because he's got the biggest platform. Right. Right. I mean, it's like if his audience was 1/10 the size, this would be 1/10 the problem. Right. And there'd be other people who would be worth talking about. I mean, this is just a general problem with podcasts and with the alternative media ecosystem. Some people, for whatever reason, you know, based on their background or based on their tendencies, have internalized, you know, institutional norms, even when they're now, you know, outdoor cats in the independent media space, and other people haven't, right? So there are people who have real academic or journalistic norms guiding them, and they're just on Substack, or they just have a podcast, and they're doing good work. And then there are people who think they're acting like journalists, and they're not, right? And this is something I've complained about with Lex Fridman, right? I mean, Lex is another very nice guy. I don't think he's ill-intentioned at all, but I mean, he's going to sit down with Putin, really, and conduct an interview. That's going to be useful for the world. I mean, that seems extraordinarily unlikely to go well. I mean, I would love Lex to prove me wrong there, but I saw how it goes when he talks to people like Tucker Carlson or Kanye West or any other controversial figure. You know, so some of those conversations have been just disastrous founts of misinformation. So it is with the All In podcast guys, right? Like, you know, I don't know, I only know Jason. I've met David Sacks once, but I can't say I know him. But I was a big fan of their podcast in the beginning when they were talking about just business stuff and, you know, entrepreneurship. And I mean, that was fun and useful. And yeah. I think they were giving a lot of valid information there to people. But once they got political, once they got deep into, you know, once David Sacks began spouting Kremlin talking points, quite literally Kremlin talking points, though he would roll his eyes at that description. And they were completely unencumbered by any, you know, valid journalistic or academic correction of this, you know, Dunning-Kruger effect that took hold over there. It's been a disaster, right? And they had Trump on and they had Tucker on, and these interviews were totally irresponsible, right? And I think quite politically consequential, right? I mean, when you look at all the legions of tech bros in Rogan's audience and in the All In podcast audience, and you know, this vibe shift that took hold in tech, those two podcasts in particular, I guess I could add Lex to that, I think were largely responsible, right? And the normalization of supporting this personality cult in Trump, I mean, you know, Elon also played his role, it's been disastrous. And I'm not sure, again, apart from an economic catastrophe, I'm not sure what is going to break the spell. But the errors that these podcast hosts have been making are absolutely obvious, right? To any real journalist or any real academic touching any one of these subjects, the errors they're making are crystal clear and totally avoidable. And so, I mean, to do this job effectively, you know, as a member of the independent media, you still have to internalize the norms that made real journalism in the past, right? And if you don't want to be a journalist, and you don't want to be an academic, and you don't want to be an intellectual, and you just want to be an entertainer, well, then don't interview Vladimir Putin, right? I mean, it's just insane to be subjecting our political process to that level of pollution in the information space. I mean, it's like, again, Joe's got effectively Holocaust deniers on his podcast at a moment where anti-Semitism has become more consequential than globally speaking than it has been since the Holocaust, right? I mean, that's his contribution to this moment. It is irresponsible.
So speaking of hosts that are not, I'll come at you pushing back, you got some shit for the Niall Ferguson podcast episode from the audience that you let him get away with murder. And I think there's something that's really great about you as a gracious host, which I'm sure you understand that they're doing the same, where I think people love you at your best is where you're gracious, but also ferocious. And I know we have Douglas Murray coming up, who's a friend and somebody that you also want to remain a gracious host to. What sort of steps are you going to take, or how do you think you'll prepare for that, or how do you think that's going to go? Or,
well, I do think that the role of being a host imposes a little bit of a constraint that isn't present when you're a guest on someone else's podcast and you can debate freely, right? Like I remember, you know, in the first, I don't know, 100 or so podcasts I recorded, I didn't really see this constraint in the same way, and I would just let it rip with guests, and I had some very, you know, famously bad podcasts. So, you know, I mean, they're good bad for some people, but they were bad for many others. I mean, they became really a slog because I just wouldn't let a point go because I didn't think it should be let go because it was a fresh piece of idiocy from this guest who wasn't making sense. But those conversations really bogged down, and some shouldn't have been released. And one I tried not to release, but then the guest effectively executed a suicide bombing on me by publicly lying about what had happened on the podcast. So I wound up releasing it under the title "The Best Podcast Ever." So I do feel like I need to be a gracious or a semi-gracious host, no matter who I'm talking to. And if I can't manage that, I probably shouldn't be talking to this person on my podcast. I mean, maybe I could be debating them on somebody else's podcast. But
why does that being a gracious host not apply to Joe Rogan?
Being a gracious host doesn't mean you don't ask a single skeptical question, right? That you don't push back against an obvious lie, that you don't fact check somebody. I mean, that's to interview someone like Trump or Tucker Carlson, people who have a history of lying that is so clear, you can't just flip on the microphone and assume this is going to be a good faith conversation, and you're now just going to amplify this person's preferred representation of themselves to your audience, right? That's genuinely irresponsible. I mean, if I couldn't really talk to President Trump on my podcast because I couldn't treat him with the requisite respect so as to make that a possible conversation, right? I mean, I think he's a purely malicious force in the world, effectively, right? I mean, even when he's just a clown, I simply do not respect him at all, really. I mean, so to have him on the podcast, I would have to honestly convey that, right? It would be an intervention from the first sentence. Now, one could argue that I shouldn't have guests like that on, right? And so it would be with Tucker and a lot of people could name Candace Owens, right? I couldn't have Candace Owens on the podcast in any normal way, right? Because she's such a liar and a conspiracy freak at this point. So I'd have to deal with that. So as polite as I would attempt to be, if I ever did such a thing, I would be trying to perform an act of surgery, informationally on this person. And that would become obvious very, very quickly. And that is the only responsible way to interview some of these people because they are such established bad actors. You can't have Vladimir Putin on your podcast and pretend that he's not a dictator who kills journalists and political opponents, right? Because he's a dictator who kills journalists and political opponents, right? So if Lex is going to go into that interview and try to turn down the screws on him, which admittedly would be a very difficult thing to do in person, right? I mean, he's going to be sitting down with a dictator who kills journalists and political opponents, surrounded by guys with guns, presumably. And this is a guy who, poisons political opponents in London with nerve agents and polonium, right? I mean, this is not, subjecting innocent bystanders in the UK to injury and death. This is not a normal interview, right? And to treat it like a normal interview would be patently insane. So, yeah. Rogan should not interview Vladimir Putin if given the chance. Absolutely not, right?
Well, what if he brings on somebody, a couple experts who can join him?
Well, yeah, but it's still his whole mode of like, we're just going to shoot the shit and we know we're both good guys here. That doesn't apply in this situation because Putin is not a good guy, right? That's so well established. It's just irresponsible to treat someone who is a malevolent psychopath as a potentially good person. It's just not real. And it has a consequence to tell tens of millions of people, to give them a fake insight into the humanity of this person, right? Like he's just a guy who goes to, he puts his pants on one leg at a time like the rest of us, that Vladimir Putin. No, he's a kleptocrat who's stolen probably over $200 billion from his increasingly impoverished country and threatened our country with nuclear annihilation. I mean, this is who you're talking to.
So back to Douglas for a second.
One of the reasons why I love Douglas. I think Douglas is a fantastic voice in the world who I love to amplify despite how much hate mail I get on his behalf. We agree about many things. I think we disagree about some things. I think we disagree. It'll be interesting to see how much we disagree about how to navigate the tensions we're talking about now. I mean, how do you navigate personal relationships with people who are acting irresponsibly in public? And he's made some very different decisions than I've made on that front, perhaps out of, you know, political necessity. I would acknowledge he's in a difficult position. You know, his audience is right of center almost entirely, and his audience is increasingly tainted by conspiracist morons and lunatics and liars and grifters and sociopaths, right, who are getting promoted to the top of this information ecosystem, and with whom he needs to pretend to play nice. And it's a real liability intellectually and ethically. You know, Ben Shapiro's in a, you know, but for the fact that he is Jewish, Ben would probably not be in the same situation. But because Ben is Jewish, right, he's now, you know, he's having to dance around the anti-Semites in his midst because he's surrounded by them, right? I mean, how does Ben navigate the space of the Daily Wire now when the Daily, you know, say, you know, the breakup with Candace Owens revealed to him in about as indelible a way as possible just how many anti-Semites he had in his audience, right? Because they took Candace's side in that split. But he's, you know, how does he share the stage with some of the right-wing grifters who grift from the anti-Semitic side of the pond? Ben and Douglas have to suffer that company in a way that I don't, right? I mean, Douglas now has to suffer the company of the people who are totally confused about the morality of the war in Ukraine because they got, you know, J.D. Vance and his politics coursing through their veins, or David Sacks and his politics, right? Yeah. And so it is with Israel and Gaza, right? I mean, Doug, there's no one who has his head screwed on straighter about with respect to Ukraine or Israel and Gaza than Douglas, right? He knows exactly which way is up there. He knows that Putin is on the wrong side of both of those conflicts, but he's surrounded by people who are confused, right, or pretend to be confused. And he has to make common cause with them, or seemingly has to make common cause with them, on other topics, right? And I don't have to play that game. I'm very grateful I don't have to play that game. But the downside of my approach to these things is I'm fairly actively burning bridges with people who used to be friends or used to be colleagues or used to be, you know, acquaintances who were almost friends. And Douglas has Douglas and I have talked about this briefly. As a point of principle, he has decided, you know, never to close doors really with anyone. He's quoting, I forget who, Roger Scruton or somebody who was a mentor figure for him. It's just like, you know, when you close a door, don't close it all the way. I forget what he said there, but he just has a view of this that is, it may be more realistic in the end than my view. I mean, I have a fairly idealistic, uncompromising view about the personal ethics entailed here. When someone lies enough and they're unrepentant enough and they behave like a sociopath long enough, at a certain point, I'm going to cut my losses and say, all right, this is, and this is happening sooner and sooner now, especially when the person is acting in public to great consequence, right? I mean, there are people who have dysfunction in their lives and for whom you, I think, need to be really forgiving of human frailty, right? You know, if I had a friend who did something awful and would I go visit him in prison? You know, yeah, I mean, that's a very likely outcome of that kind of case, right? But here we're talking about friends who have podcasts that reach millions of people, or friends who, you know, are breaking bread with the current president of the United States and helping to amplify his message, right? Or cutting him checks for $1 million and going to the inauguration. I mean, it's a very different kind of responsibility. So I'll get into all of this with Douglas. But Douglas and I agree about many things of consequence, and I'm not expecting real fireworks. I'm expecting some interesting disagreements.